Hey, Frem. Really excited for this conversation with Daniel Stillman. Daniel and I became friends in New York City because of Cave Day, a productivity community. I had the honor of interviewing one of Cave Day's co-founders, Jeremy Redleaf, in 2018. Are you familiar with conversation design? If products are designed, couldn't conversations be designed and improved as well? Daniel is an expert in conversation. He is a conversation designer. He is the host of a podcast called The Conversation Factory. He's currently working on a book. And in this episode, we also talk about facilitation, finding work, experience design, being a solopreneur, and so much more. Conversation is really important for any type of work and projects and relationships that we do. So I was so excited to have Daniel share his insights for you. As always, this episode with Timeset Notes is available on my website at portfoliocareerpodcast.com. Really excited for you to build and grow your portfolio career. Here we go with Daniel. Cool. Welcome to Portfolio Career Podcast. Your host, Damon Dubinsky, is here with Daniel Stillman. How's it going, Daniel?
Yo, yo, yo. Sorry, we're holding our microphones in a sort of a hip-hop stance, so it feels appropriate.
Yeah. And so if we were to go to an event tonight, how do you typically introduce yourself, besides your rapping career, obviously?
Yeah. No, I don't go by my stage name. Honestly, when people ask me what I do, I tell them that I'm a conversation designer. And then usually people say, what does that mean? And then I say, well, tell me what you do. And because I like to put what I do in context of what people know. And if they're like, oh, well, it's like I work in law, I was like, okay, cool. Like, so what kind of conversations do you design in your work? And they're like, well, I guess like I have to like make a brief before I like can go in to talk to my partner. Or I have to like put together like this for that. I was like, yeah, like that's what I do, is I design conversations, but for like usually big group conversations or coaching conversations and things like that. Like I design other types of conversations. And that usually, once I sort of get people to understand that they design conversations, it helps them understand the kind of conversations that I design.
Mm-hmm. And so typically when you think about designing a conversation, right, it's not just the initial. Tell us a little bit more about conversation design.
Well, so, you know, here's the thing. Like, what I do, like, often you could say, like, oh, I'm a facilitator. I met a group back in, like, 2015 that called their facilitation practice conversation design. And the first time I heard that word, I was like, that's kind of a douchey way to talk about something really normal. But it helped put what I do in context of, it's not just getting a group of people to get through an agenda, it's for something else. And it also, for me, helps me talk about the fact that to get those people into the room with the right process means I have to know what's going on. I have to design the conversation for where they are and where they need to go. And then there's an experience that we create that helps them bridge that gap. And so that's what, to me, designing the conversation means in my original context. I'm working on a book right now that's about all the other conversations we design. So when you talk about coaching, for example, if you do any coaching or have done any coaching or been to a therapist, like therapists have different designs for how they do that conversation. There's a difference between going to a Freudian versus a cognitive behavioral therapist. If you go to a coach that's like, okay, so they don't just like talk to you. They have a mental model that's helping them ask certain questions and not ask other questions. At the very simple level, a coach is not going to tell you what to do. They're going to ask you what you want, right? And that's at the very basic level, that is how they design their conversation, is like they want to get the most out of you. I just did a podcast episode with this woman. It's so cool. She works for Wayfair as head of product. She has this curve called the trust communication curve, and she draws a line from the upper left to the lower right. And her theory is, as a manager, if my teams are above the line, if they have very high communication and very high trust, it's actually a waste, right? But if they're below the line where there's not enough communication and not enough trust, that's bad. And so the way she's designing her conversations is to constantly ask, what communication can we take away? What communication can we add? How do we build trust in the right places? And from an organizational perspective, she's designing an entire organization's conversation, saying like, are we talking the same language? Are we hearing the right things? Are we having the right dialogue with the right people? So like, that's designing a conversation on a really, really much bigger scale, not just one-to-one. And so that's honestly, that's the hardest thing about this weird way I think I look at conversations now, is that people think of conversations as this, one-to-one. Whereas like, I think about it as like, oh, I design group dialogue because it's got to be designed better because it's totally broken, or organizational conversations because they're, you know, need to be tweaked in different ways. So that's when I talk about conversation design, is like, what can I do to actually shift the dialogue that's happening either at a one-to-one scale or a 1-to-100 scale, right? Like that's a really big passion for me, because I think conversations are really important, right? It's all we have, literally. Like everything we do is accomplished through conversation with other people. There's no like, the world of like, you go do this because I said so, is like, it's just not most people's reality. Like if you're leading people, you actually need to lead through conversation, right? If you're collaborating with people, you need to like collaborate through conversation, right? Even if you're a solopreneur, like you have to like deal with people through dialogue. So I think it's like, it's a very, like all scales of it are really, really important. So that's why I'm passionate about conversation design.
And now you made this really hard for me.
Because it's thinking, super meta, right?
I'm thinking, David, did I design this conversation? Have I set this up?
And but you can over or under design a conversation, right?
And what would be the pros and cons of that, of under designing a conversation?
Surprise, right? If you only do what you have always done, you'll only get what you'll have always gotten, right? That's maybe Tony Robbins said it. Maybe somebody else said it. Right, so if you over-design the conversation, then you will design all of the surprise out of it. Under-designing a conversation is like rolling over in bed and being like, "Honey, you want to get married?" Right? You're like, "That's it. That's what you did." You know, I'm pretty proud of the fact that like when people ask my fiance, like, "Oh, how did Daniel ask?" Like she's like, "Well, he did this and then he did this and it was really fun. He got all his friends involved." Like, I feel like I really tried to nail the amount of design.
Yeah. So it's really interesting to me of how you built a business around facilitation and workshops. Yeah. And for somebody that is a freelancer or starting a new project, you know, how do you think about helping people scale projects to build companies from it?
Wow. I mean, that's the always question is, why do you want to scale, right? Small and beautiful can be fine. Like right now I am just me, right? I don't really have scale anything. The podcast does help me spread my voice, right? And so that's something I do to sort of like scale my impact. And we talked about how like I have clients and friends and collaborators who listen to the podcast, and that gives like the, you know, a sheen of authority on stuff that I do.
Conversation Factory is the name of the podcast.
The Conversation Factory, where we manufacture conversations. Minted, fresh daily. But I have learned how to collaborate with others. So I think that's really important. I don't think I was always really good at that. And so right now, one of the ways that I'm scaling my impact is finding really good strategic partners who are like either the chocolate to my peanut butter, if that analogy makes sense to you, or like I'm chunky and they're smooth, and like it's a really interesting like yes and collaboration. So like my friend Douglas Ferguson, who has a company called Voltage Control, we met at a conference. Google hosts this internal sprint conference. We met at it and we were like kind of like, it's like, oh yeah, cool. Like we kind of jived with each other. He came and took my facilitation masterclass and was like, "Hey, I'm running a conference. Do you want to like do a version of the masterclass together?" And, you know, we've done it a couple of times since then. And now we're pitching work together, right? Because we've developed that intimacy where we can pitch bigger. We're talking about pitching bigger projects than, you know, he's got a bigger team than I do, but you know, I bring a different perspective, and the conversation means that something interesting comes out of it. Similarly, actually from the same conference, my friend Jay Malone has a company called New Haircut, and they focus on sprints and sprint facilitation. And we just launched a 12-week innovation leadership accelerator that we saw a gap in what we wanted to offer, you know, bigger, longer, deeper experiences for people that like really help them not just like get a skill, like let's come to a workshop and like learn a framework, but like how do you really apply it? How do you really live it in your work? And so I'm really grateful that Jay has been willing to like give up some of his time and energy to me, you know, because everybody's time is precious. Like we're all pretty much maxed out. And so when somebody says like, yeah, like let's do something together, I think that's actually a pretty big lift. And so doing something with both of these guys where we still have our own businesses, but we're doing these side projects, experiments together. And then like they catch on. I think that's how I've done pretty much every business I've ever had. It's been like, hey, what if we blanked? And then like we kind of lean startup it and we try it out. I think finding good people to collaborate with, and it depends. Like if you want to build a team, that's a whole thing. Like building a company is something that I'm not an expert in and don't really want to do right now. Finding great people to collaborate with and building trust with them in safe ways, I think is really, really valuable for sure.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk a little bit about, so going back to the conversation design little bit, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I heard you talk about it once of that it's not just the initial conversation, it's the second, third, fourth, and all these other kind of steps that then kind of happen from that. Maybe talk a little bit more about how we should think about designing, call it a big meeting or a call, and thinking about the implications after that.
Yeah, totally. Well, that's another way to think about also how to scale your impact. Like, if somebody says like, design a meeting for me, I'll say, well, where are they at now? Where are they going to be next? Like, where does this fit into your overall strategy? Who are the people? What are your business goals? And so we try to like zoom out and see the big picture, and designing it with that context in mind is always really important. So there's a couple of frameworks I use, and they kind of all revolve around this idea of what's the narrative? What's the story? Right. So I think a lot of people design meetings and workshops and experiences with just like, oh, here are the steps, right? Here are these five things we want to talk about on our agenda today. Boom, 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 boom. That's a grocery list, right? Mm-hmm. That's just like a pile of notes. It's not a song, right? The grocery list, if you just pour them out on the table, like that's not dinner, right? Mm. Dinner is a preparation, right? And a meal is an experience, right? It has an introduction and a mousse-bouche, right? An appetizer, and the rising arc of the dinner and how you finish things off with, you know, a nice aperitif and a cheese plate. Like that's a real arc of an experience. Everyone should read Setting the Table by Danny Meyer. He's definitely the guy who I would love to have on my podcast. So you talk about designing an experience, right? A meeting, a workshop, life is an experience. And the question is like, can I design an experience? You actually can't, but you can set the table for it, right? 11 Madison Park, one of Danny Meyer's actually former restaurants, one of the best restaurants in the world. You can still go there and have a lousy time if you're had a bad day or you're with a bad date, right? So he can't make you have a good experience, but he can literally set the table for it. He can just make sure that all the things happen at the right time. And he thinks about that arc from the second you walk in to the moment you leave. That's why they decided to make everything, you just pay the price. There's no tipping, because they realize at the end of the meal, there's this chaotic moment when you figure out like, oh, we're going to tip. How are we going to split it? Like, no, set menu. Everything is included, pay up front, so that the end of the experience is just as seamless as the beginning. And so there's a wide, wide variety of experience design tools that exist. And that's the world I came from product design. When you think about a product, you go from not knowing about it to knowing about it, from knowing about it to either loving it or hating it, right? And so the five E's of experience design are a perfectly legitimate way of designing any experience. The five E's came from a group called the Doblin Group. They said, like, okay, how do you entice somebody to enter into the world of this product? Once they've entered, right, how do you engage them? Like, what is the thing that really engages them once they're there and they're in it? After that engagement dies out, will they exit the experience? How will they exit it? And then if they've exited, how will you extend your relationship with them? Those five E's. I remember teaching this to, it was a couple of years ago. Acumen is a long, what's the word I'm looking for? They do impact investing, and they're slow money. They believe in slow money. So, like, what's, if we're going to change the world on some really, really important social problems?
Poverty. Yep.
Yeah, exactly. If we want to, like, invest in this emerging, like, crowdsourced ambulance company in Nigeria, we assume that we're going to get, that the money is going to sit there for a long time, and that we don't expect a big return back, but we want to seed their activity. Because they have volunteers all around the world. And the volunteer experience was something that they wanted to, like, really think about. And they got to the exit and they were like, oh my God, we never think about the exit. Mm. We don't think about what happens when somebody gets burned out and leaves the volunteer experience. Like, how do we make it so that we can welcome them back in anytime, right? That the door is always open. And so the, like, all components of the five E's are really, really valuable. And one of my first intimations that conversations like facilitation can be designed was, I was like, I'm just using the five E's. Like, how do I entice somebody? And, like, what's the email? Right. And you're an expert on that, right? Like, sending a little email with, like, you making a nice video. You're like, hey, Daniel, you want to come on my podcast? I was like, oh, that's so sweet. Like, it's so high touch. Right. And that creates an enticement, an intimacy in the enticement that was like, okay, I'm now already, I've entered in. Right. Mm. Right. And engagement is easier. Right. And so the five E's are a really, really valuable tool, like all purpose tool for, like, thinking about the arc of any experience, and a conversation, a meeting is another one. I give a talk at this conference my friend Douglas hosted where I talked about narrative arcs for facilitation. I'll give you the link to it, like, because I'm a narrative junkie, and whether it's using the hero's journey or the five E's, the four seasons model, like the winter, spring, summer, and fall of the conversation, like these metaphorical ways of talking about the conversation as a cyclical, ongoing experience, it changes your perspective. And allows you to be, like, super duper more thoughtful about it. And I think it takes people from a, okay, here's my agenda, to, like, what's the story, dude? Like, what do you want people to be leaving, feeling, and talking about, and telling someone else about, and what are they going to bring to their next meeting? Like, and then you're talking about designing for virality. That's a completely different conversation than just like, oh yeah, so we need to talk about these three agenda items. Like, who cares, right? And for some meetings, do need to be that. Like, sometimes you do just need to be like, okay, update me. Here's these three things. But the truth is, in my world, like, you talk about, like, Agile and Scrum and all these things, like, those are all narrative structures. We're like, okay, we're going to say, like, what's working? What's not working? What's holding you up? What do you need from other people? Like, if you look at the content of a stand-up meeting, that's, like, a coherent, holistic narrative that allows people to remember it, explain it to somebody else, and makes it easy to do. So, like, that's my philosophy on that.
I'm hopeful that we'll be able to exit this conversation not anytime soon, but, and then extend it beyond the five E's. That's really interesting. And it also seems, I remember you also did a lot of work on teaching design thinking to non-designers. It's just really interesting framework or model to think about. What are some tools or things that are working in certain areas? Yeah. Like you mentioned Danny Meyer and his book, and how do you bring that into other areas of your work?
Yeah. I'm a big fan of like stealing ideas from different places. And if you read Danny Meyer's book, and you and everyone should, it's a design thinking framework. You're like, oh my God, like he's innovating on food and food experiences. And so you read like collect the dots, connect the dots. Like that's like the first half of the design thinking process, right? He's just like, he's a natural at it.
Maybe can you talk to us about, you know, as you mentioned, you said you mostly like to work on your own and probably largely have done that for some of your career. Mm. Maybe talk about finding clients, finding work in New York. Yeah.
Oh man, it's a mystery. It's, you know, I think relationships are hard, right? Those are the best clients are the ones you already have, right? Losing a client sucks. I think it's funny. I was just talking to an old friend who I worked with years ago, and he's finally at a company where they have some, they've got like some budget and they've got a problem that's big enough. And he's like, hey, could you come and do a workshop for us? And it's great. I'm really looking forward to doing that with him. And it's like, that's like an arc that's like, I met this guy in 2011. We've been friends for 8 years. Like I don't see him more than like once a year. And this is like, that's the arc, right? That it can take that long for something to build. I've been really lucky that when clients introduce me to other clients, like it's all organic. On the flip side, a lot of my, like when I started one of my first design thinking, I don't know, commercial activities, you could say, like I remember using, do you know the Brooklyn Brainery? They're still around. Love the Brooklyn Brainery. They do like courses on everything under the sun. Jen and Soma started it like as like pretty much a Kickstarter. And I was teaching workshops for them, like just for fun, like on whatever. There was like physics, bread baking, cheese making, origami. I was just like going through all my skills. And then I was like, oh, like let's could do a design thinking for non-designers class. And I collaborated with my friend Miles on this. And workshops, doing public workshops, and you've played with this too, right? Like when you do a public workshop, it can be a great way of like getting your name out there and testing new material and getting people into your funnel. And so I think public workshops have always been a way of like demonstrating value to people and getting people engaged and involved with what I do. And it's a challenge though, because workshops don't always lead to clients. Right. It's not an easy funnel, right? If you do a workshop for 40 people, depending on what you're charging, yeah, right, those people may or may not be able to afford your services. Like this, so I'm sure you've gone through this question yourself where it's like, oh, like if I make it free, I'll get a ton of people to come. If I make it free, are these the people who can actually like afford what I do? Right. If I charge a lot, not a lot of people will come, but like maybe they'll be the right, maybe the people who can afford what I do at the price I want to charge. Right. And so it's definitely a battle with like, how do you find the right people inside of an organization that can like actually pull the trigger on what it is that I do? It's not trivial at all. So a lot of it is building reputation stuff. So that's why I do all the thought leadership, blah, 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 things that I do, like writing stuff on Medium and making downloads and toolkits and going on podcasts, going to events, going to conferences. It's all about connecting with people at the end of the day. I don't know, is that?
And having a conversation.
And having a conversation, starting the conversation. I think I'm not particularly good at what I would call like outbound sales. Like I don't have a one and done product where it's like, okay, here's exactly what I offer, and I'm just going to beat down doors until I find somebody who's willing to bring me on.
And so have you adjusted that? Or has it often been like that of a, let's have a conversation to talk about?
I'm a pretty conversational salesperson. I think I could do better. I'm starting to read some sales books. I'm going to have somebody on my show who has like a sales podcast. I only listened to 2 episodes and I enjoyed it already. I was like, a friend tagged him in a conversation on LinkedIn where I was like, what's your favorite sales book? And he was like, this guy. And I was like, dude, you're awesome. He's like, cool, here's my email. surprisingly generous dude. It's pretty cool. His Ian Altman, he has a podcast called and a book called Same Side Selling, where it's about like thinking about sales from the same side, not as an oppositional conversation. And it's so true. It's like sales is not like I'm selling you. It's like we are trying to create value together, mm-hmm. right? Especially for the kind of stuff that you do and the stuff that I do. It's not like I'm just selling you. You know, even if I'm just like selling you pens, it's like, do you need the pens? Do you want the pens? Right? Do they create value for you? And it's not about pushing what you have on someone else. It's trying to find a way to make and create value. I just had a call with somebody where I've known this guy for like a couple of years. We have coffee a couple of times a year. And he's like, oh yeah, we have this thing. Like he sent me a client. He's like, would this be right for you? I'm like, I don't know if I can do it that time. Maybe I can help you in another way. Maybe I can't help him at all. Like, and so I'll try to send him to someone else who can. Like, I think that's the essentials of like, that was like my first high school job. Like, that's what they taught us. Like, if we don't have the shoes, tell them where they can find it. Right. Like, that's just being like a helpful person. So like finding clients, I know I'm not giving you any helpful tricks, but I think the question is always like, who can buy your service? Where are they? And go to where they are, right? That's the very basics. And if you think about it, it's like the five E's, like what will entice them? Like what actually will get them in the door? That's the question.
I'm curious to learn a little bit more about the Conversation OS or the operating system. I know that could maybe go for a while, but I just thought that it was really fascinating when I was looking into a little bit more of your work.
Yeah.
And just want to make sure we maybe talked about a lot of the key elements of your work. And
thanks, man. That's very thoughtful of you. I'll say this. As a design person, this is the story I tell. It's like when I was doing industrial design, if you want to make a better physical product, it's pretty clear what you're changing when you're changing it, right? I went to this school that was very like Bauhaus, old school. Like we talked about like, oh, this curve is slow and then it speeds up, right? We think about the materiality of something, you know, color, form, all these things. Physical design is like really physical. It's super tactile. When you start doing UX work and experience design work, that's when you're like, what am I actually designing here? And that's where experience design frameworks helps you like concretize what it is I'm actually doing when I design an experience. So the five E's gives you something to hold on to and say, okay, I'm going to focus on this moment in the experience and I want to make it more intense or I want to cool it off, right? The customer's experience right here is they're sad, I want to make them happy, or they're happy and I want to make them like just, you know, satisfied, whatever it is you just really think about that arc of the experience. And with conversations, I think the question of like, what am I designing when I design a conversation is like, really, it was a pickle for me. And so honestly, when I started my podcast, it was really with the question of like, if we are designing conversations, what are we actually designing when we design them? And so the operating system was me trying to make it as simple as possible for people to say like, okay, maybe there's like a million things. And I do an exercise when I do these workshops on designing conversations where I say like, what's a conversation made out of? And people say, I don't know, throw something out. What's a conversation made out of?
Emotions.
Emotions, sure. Tone of voice.
Ideas.
Vibes.
Expectations.
Yeah. Agreements.
Power.
Disagreements. Right? Like you could like, and you put that all on sticky notes and you put it on the wall, you get a crazy map of like a million things. And then you ask yourself like, okay, what can I actually change? Like emotions are really hard to change, right? I don't know about you. It's hard for me to change my emotions. So it's enough that I have them, right? I do enough work. You know, I've been doing men's group work like Jeremy does for like a year now. Like just being able to successfully decide that I'm actually experiencing emotion, big thumbs up. But changing them, really hard, right? So like, can I change the emotions to change the conversation? No, not so much. Like vibes, similarly. Power is a really interesting thing. Power is a huge component in dialogue. And I was literally just rewriting about this today. Like, how can I actually change power? And when I'm a facilitator and I'm teaching facilitators, the first thing I say is change where you're standing. So I'll send you a link to one of my favorite New Yorker cartoons where a guy is in a suit at the wall with a sticky note. And there's a bunch of people around the table. And he's like, all right, everybody, why don't you shout out some ideas at me? And I'll keep writing them down until this sticky note is filled up. Mm-hmm. And like, that's so wrong for so many ways. Like, why is he the person with this pen? Why is everyone sitting down while he's standing up? Why is he using a tiny sticky note to capture the ideas of an entire room full of people? And so as a facilitator, I always ask people, like, why are you up at the front of the room? It's a choice. There's nothing wrong with being at the front of the room and holding the pen and writing everything down. A lot of people think that that's what a facilitator is. I'm taking power because I've taken the pen and I'm at the front. But you can also be behind the group and they're all at the wall and you're saying, okay, everybody, write that down and stick it up over here and move it there. That's a different type of power, right? And the way you set up your space dictates what kind of power people expect to exist. And so things like time, like how much time are we speaking for? How fast are we talking? How do we take turns? Like right now, like this is an interview, quote unquote interview. So like you're asking me short, clear questions and I'm like bloviating, right? We could treat this more like a conversation where we're going back and forth. If you're talking with a friend and he just talks the whole time, you're like, and he does it every time, you're probably not going to want to hang out with that friend anymore. Hmm. And so turn-taking is really important in conversations. When you have 3, 4, or 5 people, how do you manage who gets to talk and when? Do you have a talking stick? Sure, maybe. Like that's one way to control turn-taking. So there's like all of these factors in conversations. I boil it down to like, what are 9? Because it's a nice box. Like, is it 1? Is it 3? Is it 5? Is it 13? Like, maybe. Where the conversation happens. So, like, every conversation has an interface, a space where it happens, and that affects the conversation. We're doing this in person instead of Zoom, mm-hmm. right? We could be doing this on the beach instead of at the Norwood Club, right? That would change the conversation. We'd be like more relaxed if it was sunny outside and our feet were in the water. Like that's really basic stuff. But I've been at meetings where we can't use the walls, right? How many disagreements have you had over text messaging? Right. And so it gets better and you just have to Google like text message confusion from Key and Peele to see like what happens when you can have disagreements over text messages. And so that interface for the conversation either supports it or doesn't support it. Like text messaging is great if you're bar hopping and somebody tries to call you and you're like, dude, we're in a bar. I can't hear you. I texted you the next bar, right? Mm-hmm. So the interface of the conversation, like where it's actually happening is important. Power and how do you handle power? Do you take power? Do you give power? Do you fight power? Do you dance with power? Like what's your own operating system when it comes to power? Turn taking, like how do we manage turns? The cadence of the conversation, is it fast or is it slow? Right? Is it speeding down? Is it slowing up? And a few other components, 9 in total. I can, you know, they can download it from my website. To me, it's like, it's just helped me focus my attention and different levers become more important to me at different times. Like at one point, I actually had the invitation. Like invitation is how do you invite somebody into the conversation? Is it a nice invitation or is it a insistent invitation? That used to be at the center because I felt like invitation was mm-hmm. really, really critical, and it is. But for the more I've taught it to people, the more I realize that like interface and space is like where they all connect. And so that's in the center now. And it's all based on a, you know, what I think is a thoughtful model of how conversations work. And we'll see if the book helps make any of these ideas at all clear. It's hard to like pull all these things out of my head. It's been like 2.5 years of the podcast and trying to clarify these ideas as much as possible for myself so that I can explain it to other people. But the OS is like how I help myself think about designing conversations in a really different way. It's not like the 5 E's, which is implying like linearity. It's not saying how you should do it. It's saying, here are the, it's like flour, butter, eggs, salt, milk. You can make scones, you can make muffins, you can make pancakes. I don't care what you do with them, but like, here are the ingredients, okay. You know? We can talk about how to put them together like that's a separate thing.
Yeah. Okay.
Is that, I don't know. Is
no,
that,
that's perfect. I haven't heard the overview from you before. And I think this is a good place to exit gracefully. Hopefully it's, and you believe it's a good way to exit. Please let listeners know how they can follow up with the podcast and the book.
Yeah.
And continue the conversation. Or, yeah, yeah. Sorry, extend
the conversation. Yeah, you can find the podcast. You can just look for The Conversation Factory. That's also the website of the podcast, and that's where I talk about some consulting stuff. Occasionally, I'm on Twitter. That's D.A. Stillman on the Twitters. Those are the places you can find me. I think those are the things. And there's a ton of resources on... I'm also on Medium, and I write about this stuff as clearly as I can. So people, if they want to learn more about this stuff, like they can Google all those things.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Daniel. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. You ask really, really lovely questions. I really appreciate the opportunity to think with you.
Thank you. Likewise. Right. Hey, friend. This episode with timestamp notes is available on my website at portfoliocareerpodcast.com. I'm really excited for you to learn from this episode and would love to hear any thoughts from you and continue the conversation where I post this episode on many different social channels. Please subscribe to wherever you listen to your podcast for my weekly Portfolio Career Podcast show. And really excited for you to build and grow your portfolio career. Thank you so much.